This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The number of weekly attacks in Iraq has fallen, and that's good news. But according to my guest, Tom Ricks, the larger story is more complex than it may seem. Ricks is the military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. He's been reporting from Washington and Iraq. His latest trip to Iraq was November 2nd through the 10th. Tom Ricks, welcome back to Fresh Air. Reports have just come out about how violence is down in Iraq, a 55% drop in attacks since the launch of the surge 9 months ago. The purpose of the surge was to create a more peaceful atmosphere so that the political process could move forward. So the surge was effective, apparently, in decreasing violence. Has it been effective in moving the political process forward?
I think the surge definitely has had that tactical effect of improving security. But judged on the terms in which the president presented it last January, saying that we were doing this to improve security in order to have a breathing space for political reconciliation, judged on those terms, the surge has failed.
Well, let me read something that you wrote in a recent article. You report that senior military commanders now say that the biggest threat facing the U.S. effort in Iraq isn't al-Qaeda terrorists or Sunni insurgents or Iranian-backed militias. It's the intransigence of Iraq's Shiite-dominated government. In what areas has the government been so extreme or uncompromising that the military now considers the government the big problem?
This was really striking to me. I think this is probably the single biggest sort of memory or image I took away from this trip to Iraq, was just how frustrated the American military is growing with the government that we helped create in Baghdad. I was having lunch one day with two officers in the mess hall of the 1st Cavalry Division at Camp Liberty, west of Baghdad. And the more I listened to them, the more I realized they talked more sympathetically about the former insurgents than they did about our so-called allies in the Baghdad government. And I pointed this out to them at the end of the lunch, and they said, well, yeah. They said, you know, the insurgents kind of did what they had to do, but these guys in the Baghdad government are really frustrating us. And you heard this again and again. I heard this again and again from commanders that they're worried that they've created an opportunity through the blood and sweat and treasure of the American people and their offspring. Over the last 6 months, security has improved, but that the Baghdad government is not willing to take advantage of that, is not reaching out to the Sunnis, is not reciprocating the Sunni gestures that say, hey, just give us a place at the table. We understand we lost this situation, but let us be part of the future of Iraq. What they're finding is the Baghdad government is saying, hey, politics in this country is a zero-sum game. You lose, you get nothing.
So the way you're describing it, the decrease in violence in Iraq over the past 9 months and the growing suspicion between Shia and Sunnis are kind of flip sides of the same coin. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't want to underplay the change in security in Iraq. I think it's very important. I think I've lost track of how many trips I've made to Iraq. It's at least 10. This was the first trip I've been on in which security was better than on my previous trip. This is the first time that the situation felt better. For example, when I was in Iraq last spring, I was in the green zone and counted 20 mortars hitting or rockets hitting the green zone. On this entire trip, I only heard 7 mortar shells the whole time. I used to hear a car bomb at least once a day. This trip, I only heard, I think, 1 bomb go off in 8 days I was there. I used to hear 50 or 100 rounds of automatic weapons fire, machine gun fire. This trip, I heard maybe 10 rounds a day. So it is much better. That said, I keep on thinking of a remark that a general said to me, General Barbero, one of the senior American commanders. He said, Iraq was never as bad as it was, and it's not as good as it's being reported now. That is to say, yes, there have been improvements, but inside the military, there are a lot of worries that you could really lose these improvements, especially if the Baghdad government doesn't get off the dime. And so they're worried that every day you have improved security without political movement is another day lost that we'll never get back.
Tom, you write that the military approach in Iraq this year has been to focus on striking deals with Sunni insurgents under which they stop fighting Americans and instead protect their own neighborhoods. Would you describe what kind of deals these are, you know, like how they're arranged, what they are?
It's very murky, and the American commanders really don't talk much about them. partly because, as they recognize, a lot of these people are not what we would call the good guys. A lot of these people they're cutting deals with are people who have killed American troops. In a sense, it's like going into South Central L.A. and giving badges to the Crips and saying, okay, you guys are now part of the local police. And part of the problem with this is that the Prime Minister of Iraq doesn't like these deals and is kind of undermining them a bit. We say, here's a bunch of former insurgents who have signed up to become policemen in this town, and they find that the Baghdad government drags its feet in enrolling these people. We are giving them a lot of money. I was just reading today through some documents. We have this thing called CERP funds. C-E-R-P is the acronym. They're given to American commanders on the ground. I think it's called Commander's Emergency Reconstruction Program funding. We've given Iraq, we've spent in Iraq $2.3 billion under that program. A lot of that money has gone to these local sheikhs who might also be insurgent leaders as a kind of way of cutting deals with them. And we're giving them money. They like that. They also are finding that we are willing to work with them in a way the Baghdad government isn't. But it leads to this odd situation where we are now in some ways, our American officers are proving to be more sympathetic to these former insurgents than they are to the Baghdad government.
Have we done this with al-Qaeda in Iraq? And does that explain why al-Qaeda in Iraq's attacks have so greatly diminished?
I don't think we've done it with al-Qaeda in Iraq. What the Americans tried to do was draw a sharp distinction between what they called reconcilables and irreconcilables. Irreconcilables were people who just really wanted to kill Americans and to stir up a civil war inside Iraq. And al-Qaeda in Iraq really falls into that group. The larger group, which is essentially Sunni insurgents who were fighting partly out of self-respect, partly because they were being paid to fight, and partly because they couldn't see any other way to get a place at the table in the post-Saddam Hussein Iraq. For all those reasons, they were fighting. At the same time, the Americans said these guys could be drawn into some sort of negotiations and some sort of deals. And they have been in large numbers. It began in Anbar province and has spread somewhat. It actually began when some local sheikhs and insurgents went to the Americans and said, hey, you may see us attacking a building this afternoon. Please don't use your airplanes to strike at us. We're not attacking your people. We're going after al-Qaeda. And the Americans stood back for a couple of times and said, okay, let's watch this. This is interesting. And then there were some conversations. Hey, if you guys are genuinely interested in fighting al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Americans said, can we help you out here? And there actually were some deals back and forth, some information sharing. The Americans, I think, were able to say, okay, we have satellites. We can give you images of that compound where the al-Qaeda guys are if you want to go after them. And I think it kind of grew out of that kind of temporary alliance on the battlefield. At one point in Baghdad, some insurgents were fighting al-Qaeda and went to the Americans and said, we're just telling you, please don't shoot at us. We're having a fight here. The Americans said, we'd like to help you out. And they actually started fighting side by side against al-Qaeda because the insurgents were getting hit pretty hard by al-Qaeda. And then some advisors came in, some American advisors came in to work with these former insurgents. And the insurgents said, no, we don't want to work with you. We want to work with the American troops we've been fighting alongside. So the various sort of handshake deals were arrived at, and that's kind of where it's at now. The question is, how long will these handshake deals last? Will the Sunnis lose faith in this approach? And will the war change into something else that we don't know over the next 6 months?
So you've outlined two different strategies that the American military in Iraq has used to decrease the violence. One was to align itself with Sunnis who were fighting al-Qaeda in Iraq, and the other is to cut deals with insurgents so that they get some money, they get to police their own neighborhoods in return for stopping their part of the insurgency. Are these things that mainly account for the dramatic decrease in violence that we've seen in Iraq?
They account for a very big part of the decrease in violence. But another part of the decrease comes from the simple fact that Baghdad is essentially an ethnically cleansed city at this point. It's much less of a mixed city than it was a couple of years ago. And lots of neighborhoods that used to be overwhelmingly Sunni are now overwhelmingly Shiite. And the fighting for those neighborhoods has stopped. The Sunnis simply have left. 2 million people have fled the country. That's almost 10% of the population of the country. And one of the worries is next year, if security continues to improve, a lot of the Sunnis might come back. They're running out of money from their exile in Jordan or Syria or Egypt, and they do want to come home. The problem is their homes are now occupied by Shiite squatters. And when these Sunnis come back and say, I want my old house back, what will the Iraqi security forces do? Remember, the Iraqi security forces, the police and army, are overwhelmingly Shiite, especially the police. And the police have acted frequently in a sectarian manner, as if they were simply the biggest Shiite militia around. And so it's a really open question, and one that American planners are already worried about. What happens when the Sunnis come home and say, we want our houses back?
So even if there's some stability now, that there's so many ways that that can be ended by the next turn of events.
This is actually one of the themes that American commanders emphasized to me in my interviews with them, which is this is far from over, and it probably looks a little bit better in a situation than it really is. They can see a lot of ways that it can go wrong, and they can only see a couple of ways that it could go right. And the big worry is simply that this opportunity that's presented itself, they feel they've kind of opened a window of opportunity with these moves to improve security. The big worry is that that simply is going to slip by, and Iraq will slide back down the hill into the mess it was in for all of 2006. And every time that happens, it's harder to get back out of that situation. There's a lot of people who feel that Uncle Sam has made these promises now, you know, and said, we're going to help you find a place in the future Iraq. But if Uncle Sam isn't able to force the Shiite government to reach out and show a little bit of generosity of spirit, I think the Sunnis might become quite bitter. The other problem is provincial elections. The Americans see provincial elections as the only way to really start having political progress. They've kind of given up on the Maliki government really reconciling itself in any fashion to the Shiites. The problem with provincial elections is they're going to be bloody, they're going to be rough, and so it's going to make Iraq look more violent. So do you want to do it right now or in the next few months when you still have a lot of these so-called surge troops around, the 5 extra combat brigades that were moved in this year? Or do you wait and let the sense of security seep in more and let Iraqis enjoy a breather of sorts? And do you wait until maybe next fall? The problem with that is, do you lose the Sunnis while you wait? And also, you wind up holding the elections, which are going to be nasty, on the eve of the American presidential election. And it means that in September and October of 2008, you might have bloody scenes of Iraq all over the evening news again, which is certainly not something the Republicans would like to see.
There's currently an investigation into Blackwater, a private military contractor that was providing security to American diplomats and others in Iraq. And, you know, they're being accused of having fired on and killed several Iraqi civilians without cause. What is the reaction that you heard in the American military to the reliance that we've had in this war on private military contractors who aren't accountable to the military?
This actually came up a lot in conversations frequently initiated by officers rather than me. What you find is a real loathing and contempt for Blackwater and the other private security contractors, a feeling that they're a bunch of cowboys, and then they come in to an area an American commander's trying to deal with, and they mess things up, and you don't know they're there, they don't coordinate, they don't tell you they're coming through, and most of all, that they don't have the best interest of the country in mind. All they're there is to make a buck by executing their contract, and their contract is to keep their principal alive, to perform their bodyguard function at the expense of everything else. American troops know that sometimes you might have to die in the course of your duty rather than, say, kill a bunch of kids. And they really make sacrifices in executing their duty. And they're very unhappy when they see these guys cowboying it up, as the term they use, acting like a bunch of cowboys. I was actually talking to a brigade commander about this, and I said, would you want the responsibility of having these guys in your chain of command, of having to discipline them? And he said, absolutely. He said, it would be a lot of extra work to try to keep these tabs on these guys, but it's a lot better than having them just shoot through my, what he calls my battle space, my area, without me knowing about it and messing up the area and maybe undercutting my progress. I think that the security contractor situation has really come into relief this year, though, because for years, some American units acted in a way not unlike the way the security contractors act. They would shoot up any cars that came close to them. They kind of shot first and asked questions later. Under General Petraeus, the American troops are operating very differently. They've been told explicitly by General Petraeus that their top priority is protecting the Iraqi people. And that's a real change from the American posture of, say, 03, 04. So now you have a situation where the way Blackwater operates is in sharp contrast to American operations. And I think it's really cast a harsh new light on the contractors that has taken them by surprise.
There are a lot of troops in Iraq who have been held over, what, two or three times? Am I exaggerating the number?
Well, they've done two or three tours, but what they have now is their tours are being extended from 12 months to 15 months. And a lot of people out there are doing 15 months now, 15-month tours of duty.
From what you could tell on your recent trip to Iraq, how are troops reacting to that?
I was struck at the variations in morale. Overall, I'm surprised at how good morale is in the U.S. military. If you had told me 5 years ago what they would go through, and without any increase in the size of the military, with only 1% of the American population carrying the burden of this war, you told me all that, I would have predicted plummeting morale in the military. It's been a surprise to me that actually morale has been as good as it is. That said, I do think morale is sinking in certain parts of the military. This was the first trip I've been on in which more than one officer spontaneously brought up with me in an interview the issue of morale of the troops around them, saying, I'm seeing poor morale. This wasn't universal. It was far from universal. I think morale still generally is pretty good. But in certain units, people said morale is really bad here. These extra 3 months on our second tour here are really disturbing families. Wives back home are saying, you got to make a choice, me or the Army. You're also seeing it in captains. One thing I found, I asked whenever I was interviewing a captain, I'd say, are you planning on staying in? And every single captain I asked said no. And then I'd say, are any of your friends staying in? And a couple of captains said no. Every friend of mine as a captain is planning on leaving too. That's worrying a lot of people in the Army.
Is it just Army captains who are not re-upping? Like, why did you single them out?
Well, it's Army captains in particular who are punching out. West Point graduates have a 5-year service obligation, so they can't leave as second lieutenants or first lieutenants, usually. They're usually captains by the time they can get out, and so a lot of them are saying, that's it, I'm out of here. In fact, I'm told that the departure rate for Army officers who graduated from West Point is skyrocketing. It is much higher than it was, say, 10 or 15 years ago. It's also the age at which people have to start making decisions about whether they're going to make a career inside the military. If you've been in 5, 7, 10 years, you're probably in your late 20s, early 30s. And it's still easy to make the transition from there and say, go to business school, go to law school, get on with another career. It's much harder if you're, say, 40. And at that point, you've been in 15, 18 years. Why not stay until you've been in 20 and get the full retirement benefits? So there's a couple of demographic reasons that force people to start making decisions about the time that they're captains about whether to stay in. The surprising thing is how many people are saying, that's it, I'm out of here, I'm leaving. And it's something you hear a lot of worry about inside the Army.
Anything else you want to share with us before our time is up?
If anything, I think just the sense of being in the air in Iraq right now. It's not like people are walking around talking about how happy they are. They're all walking on eggshells now. They're really tired in Iraq. They've been going through this really agonizing experience for 4 years, coming off of living under Saddam Hussein. The last 5 years have been especially bad for them because they thought it was over, and it wasn't. And it actually, for many of them, life got much worse. So I was really struck when I talked to Iraqis I knew and I'd seen before, just how on edge they seemed. They want to be hopeful, but they've had their hopes dashed so many times that they're almost more nervous now than they've been in the past. It's one thing to know you're going to be shot at today. It sort of focuses you. But if you're hoping things are getting better, if you're trying to figure out, do I bring my family back now? These are sort of a bunch of agonizing new questions, and they really don't know. Is this simply a lull, or is this the beginning of a new, better phase of life for them? And so I think there's a lot of new anxiety I sensed at the same time that they're kind of saying things are getting better, cross your fingers.
Well, Tom Rooks, good to have you back in the States, and thank you as always for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Tom Rooks is military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq.